calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. You can drop in and say hi. You can also participate in our message board, our blog there, our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. The U.S. is barring its doors to foreign scholars. By the way, our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy, effort and courage are not enough without purpose and direction. And tragically, that's the purpose and direction that we've been getting from this administration up until this point has been the old Reagan mantra of government is bad, corporations are good, and there's nothing in between, and democracy and capitalism and free enterprise are all the same thing, and it's all wrong, and it's not working, and it's running this country into the ditch. And in the meantime now, here we have an administration that is using its doctrinaire policies. You know, how dare anybody criticize us, right? Any foreign intellectuals who might have criticized this government. Now, we're not talking about people who are supporting terrorists. We're talking about simply criticizing the Bush administration. The Patriot Act is being used against these folks, as the Christian Science Monitor reported this weekend in an article by Alexander Marx. Concern is mounting that the U.S. government is using anti-terror laws, namely the Patriot Act, to revive a now discredited practice common during the Cold War, the prevention of foreign intellectuals who are critical of administration policies from entering the country and sharing their views with Americans. This is called ideological exclusion. And in 1990, we passed a law making it illegal. But the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Penn American Center for Freedom of Information Act are asking the Bush administration why. Why? For example, Tariq Ramadan, prominent Swiss Muslim scholar who condemns terrorism. The guy's not a terrorist. He's not he condemns terrorism. University of Notre Dame offered him a teaching job. He had to apply for a visa. The Bush administration said, no, we won't give you a visa. University of Notre Dame says, why? U.S. government says, we don't have to tell you. We got the Patriot Act. Or Dora Maria Telez, a Nicaraguan government official. She was involved in the overthrow of the Somoza regime. You'll remember Mr. Somoza, the strong-arm dictator that we propped up for some time. Harvard University offered her a teaching job. In January, she applied for a visa, and the government, our government, your government and mine, the federal government, said, nope, we're not going to let Dora Maria Telez into this country. Why? We're not going to tell you. I mean, this is incredible. This is just absolutely incredible. This is the kind of thing that Stalin did. This is the kind of thing that Khrushchev did. I remember, you know, the first time I went to the Soviet Union, I had to apply for a visa. And I had to have a sponsor. I had to have, you know, somebody in the country who would vouch for me. I had to have, you know, somebody in the country who would say who I was and where I was going. I basically had to submit my CV, my biography. And well, they did let me in because I was going to do business. I was a businessman at the time. Oh yeah, he's gonna bring some money in, maybe. But it's like, I mean, this is so bizarre that the government of the United States, we are supposed to be the beacon of liberty for the world. Now, we do have a history of denying people entrance if their political views are different from our government. The Alien Sedition Acts, for example, in 1798 were used to keep out aliens and put down sedition, right? This was John Adams passed this thing. Did I say 1898? 1798. Excuse me. 1798. This was 2 years into his presidency. John Adams. The bottom line is that his wife, Abigail, was sick and tired of his political opponents, principally his vice president, Thomas Jefferson, and the party that was quickly forming around Thomas Jefferson, the Democratic Republicans, originally known as the Anti-Federalists. She got sick and tired of being criticized. And so she said, you know, she basically harassed her husband into passing this law, although he was entirely enthusiastic about it, John Adams. Didn't trust the people. Passing this set of laws, collectively known as the Alien Sedition Acts, that said if anybody spoke out against not just the government, but the president specifically, if anybody spoke out against John Adams, they could go to jail. And, you know, it passed by one vote in Congress, and they put an expiration date on it of March 1800, which was the last, March 1st, 1800, which was the last day that John Adams would be president. And Thomas Jefferson came into office. The first thing he did was he revoked the Alien Sedition Act. I mean, it was incredible. Sedition Acts, Adams put over 20 newspaper publishers and editors into prison. You had Matthew Lyon, who was a congressman from Vermont, on the floor of the House of Representatives, stood up and said to Roger Griswold, who was the congressman from Connecticut, said that accused him of defending the interests of the wealthy and the well-born. The well-born and the well-bred was the phrase that Matthew Lyon used. And Griswold was so incensed by this that he came over with a cane and struck Matthew Lyon in the head. Matthew Lyon grabs a poker out of the fireplace there in the House chamber, tries to defend himself. The rest of members of Congress wrestle these two guys to the ground. Matthew Lyon then goes on to not just criticize Griswold, but to criticize John Adams as well. Refers to him as toothless, bald, and querulous. So John Adams has him thrown into prison. They arrest him in Washington, D.C., put him on the back of a horse in handcuffs, ride him all the way up to Vergennes, Vermont, throw him into a jail cell, into an unheated jail cell where he sits for a year and a half. He runs for Congress from his jail cell and wins in the election of 1800. Thomas Jefferson frees him. He frees all the newspaper publishers. He issues formal apologies to them. He has the government appropriate money to reimburse them for the loss of their businesses, those who hadn't died while they were in jail or fled the country under John Adams. Are we going back to the Adams administration? It sure seems like it. And then you've got these nouveau historians out there trying to turn John Adams into some sort of, wasn't he a wonderful president? Yeah, right. As Donna Eubin, counsel for the AAUP, that's the American Association of University Professors, said this about these two examples. There are several. These are the two most prominent. Tariq Ramadan, the Swiss Muslim scholar whose visa was denied. Notre Dame wanted to hire him. Dora Maria Teles, a former Nicaraguan official. Harvard University wanted to hire her. Her visa was denied. As Donna Eubin of the AAUP said, this is about free speech, the purpose of colleges and universities. We're not challenging the USA Patriot Act itself. We're just asking for information about its application to these particular scholars when there is no evidence that they have supported terrorism in any way. In other words, this challenge to this law, to the Patriot Act, is not even saying that there's anything wrong with the Patriot Act, although I think that they should. They're saying, why are you denying these people visas when they have not done anything to violate the Patriot Act? It's incredible. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. At some point you say, you know, what is going on with our government? That's the bad news. The good news. Magazine. This is from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. A second Time magazine reporter has been asked to testify in the CIA leak case. This time about our discussions with Karl Rove's attorney, a sign that prosecutors are still exploring charges against Karl Rove. Viveka Novak, and I've been trying to find out if she has any relationship to Robert Novak. Haven't found anything so far. Reporter in Time's Washington Bureau, cooperating with Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald, who's investigating a leak of Valerie Plame's name back in 2003. It's fascinating. From the time that Pearl Harbor happened until the end of World War II, That is a shorter period of time than from 9/11 to today. And from the time that Watergate first broke until Richard Nixon resigned is a shorter period of time than from when Valerie Plame was outed until today. I mean, this administration, they can't fight a war, and they've been very good at stalling off this investigation. But, actually, I shouldn't say they can't fight a war. They can't find a decent one to fight. Novak, as Rittner contributed to articles quoting Luskin, this is Viveka Novak, that sums up the nature of Rove's and Matthews Cooper's conversations. Interesting to see how this thing shakes out, too. It's 16 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives never felt so good.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Rub it all, tell me, live in the moment. Don't get too far ahead, don't live in the past.
I've been my and welcome back, my friends.
I guess another day has passed, but it's just another day.
21 minutes past the hour. On the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or, well, at least, how about voting machines that actually record the vote? Or how about even a vote without voting machines? Bob Fitrakis, it is being reported, will be announcing tomorrow that he is running for governor of Ohio. That's the good news. The bad news is he will be running on the Green Party ticket. Not that I have any problem with the Greens. I'm just concerned that what might happen in what happened in Vermont when I lived there will happen in Ohio. We had a Republican, a Democrat, and a progressive. Anthony Polina was the progressive, a friend of mine actually, who running, you know, for this position. And the Republican won with less than half of the vote because the majority of the vote was split between the Democrats and the progressives. The Progressive Party in Vermont is sort of like the Green Party everywhere else. And wouldn't that be a shame? But we're going to try and get Bob on and talk about this. We'll see where we go with this thing. In the meantime, this new Downing Street memo, I mean, this is a big deal now. The British tabloid, this last week it first came out, last Tuesday, the British tabloid The Daily Mirror, which I believe is owned by Murdoch. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. Reported that Bush wanted to bomb Al Jazeera in Qatar. Qatar, the country where we've got all the bases and, you know, our staging ground to go into Iraq, and of course the headquarters of Al Jazeera. It's a Qatari company. He wanted to bomb it. Now, this is a network who has lost several of their correspondents. They've had their offices bombed by the U.S. military. Each time we said, oh, it was just a coincidence. Oh, it was just a mistake. According to the Mirror, Bush comes over. Actually, it was Blair comes over to the United States in April and is talking with Bush. And Bush says, you know, I want to bomb April 16. Says, I want to bomb Al Jazeera. Blair talks him down. Says, this isn't, you know, you don't want to be doing this. One source cited by the Mirror said Bush was deadly serious, as was Blair. That much is absolutely clear from the language used by both men. So there's this five-page transcript of their conversation. And now this very strange thing is going on. On the one hand, the Blair administration is saying, yeah, there, you know, it's there's no such thing. It's not a problem. You know, it's Bush didn't do that. And on the other hand, they're prosecuting these two guys who released the information, David Keogh and Leo O'Connor, former researcher and former cabinet official, been charged under the Official Secrets Act for receiving and passing a secret. So let's see. Nothing to worry about. It's not a secret. By the way, these guys are going to go to jail for talking about it. By the way, if newspapers talk about it anymore, because it's the UK and there's no First Amendment, they can go to jail too. Boris Johnson, a Tory MP, writes in the Daily Telegraph today that he's quite prepared to see the Daily Mirror is wrong. But he noted if there is one thing that would seem to confirm the essential accuracy of the story, it's that the Attorney General has announced that he's going to prosecute anyone printing the exact facts. He goes on to say, if someone passes me the document within the next few days, I will be very happy to publish it in The Spectator and risk a jail sentence. The public needs to judge for themselves. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. Asked about the report in the Daily Mirror, the White House refused to deny it. They just said, this is too outlandish for a response, which, by the way, brings us to Scotty. Scotty McClellan. How long has it been since anybody has seen Scotty McClellan? A lot of people are a little curious about this. It turns out that it's been 19 days since McClellan has done an official press conference, an on-the-record press briefing, 19 days ago. So we'll see. Is Scotty McClellan on his way out of the job? Has he gotten sick of it? Is he saying that's it? By the way, Duke Cunningham, Randy Duke Cunningham, the Republican congressman from California, living in the yacht of the lobbyist, the whole thing, he's going to plead guilty to tax violations, just as an FYI. And Republican Governor Ernie Fletcher of Kentucky, the guy who's promised to make government more efficient, apparently made it more efficient by hiring lots of friends of his. Taxpayers in Kentucky are paying $42,420 annually to one of the new well-connected political appointees. These 159 principal assistant positions have been given new titles by the governor. Jimmy Holliday in the transportation cabinet, this guy a good buddy of the governor's, he was originally appointed to a post answering phones but refused to do his job. So then Deputy Transportation Secretary Dick Murgatroyd asked in an email to a policy advisor, so do we have another place to put him where he will work? Otherwise, put him in a corner and we'll ignore him. Instead of being fired, as is Republican tradition, the friend of the Republican governor who refused to work was promoted. Yep, it's right there, bluegrassreport.org. You can read all about it. Or thinkprogress.org. Amazing. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. And the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News.
And welcome back, my friends. Daily 34 news, minutes past the hour. Yes, the Daily News. Oh, my goodness. Welcome back. So glad to have you with us. And I would say it's, a great time for a conservative alert. The cons, they're always up to something, right? Well, this time, it's Fox News. It is Fox News. Sure enough, here we have Chris Wallace. Good old Chris Wallace, who once actually had a real career in real journalism. Chris Wallace claims Bush never linked Saddam and Al-Qaeda. Yeah, he really said Chris Wallace, he says, that specific quote there where you say he couldn't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, he wasn't saying that they were linked at all. The he is, of course, George Bush that Chris Wallace is referring to. He was saying one was as bad as the other. And when he said in that same answer something about that Saddam Hussein would like to use a terrorist network, he wasn't saying that they would like to use Al-Qaeda. So you're making a link there that the president never made. Okay, so here we have Fox News, Chris Wallace saying the president never linked Al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein. All right, and millions of people all across America, watching Fox News, kind of had that impression that George Bush never linked Al-Qaeda to Saddam Hussein, and so those poor members of Congress must have just been deluded, right? And anybody who said, you know, George Bush was lying to us when he linked al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, they must just be deluded, right?
Saddam Hussein has longstanding, direct, and continuing ties to terrorist networks. Senior members of Iraqi intelligence and al-Qaeda have met at least 8 times since the early 1990s.
Wrong.
Iraq has sent bomb-making and document forgery experts to work with al-Qaeda.
Wrong.
Iraq has also provided al-Qaeda with chemical and biological weapons training.
Lie.
And an al-Qaeda operative was sent to Iraq several times in the late 1990s for help in acquiring poisons and gases.
Yeah, and it turns out now that the Bush administration itself will be the first to tell you none of this is true. Now, what they won't tell you, although it is acknowledged broadly, is that at the time, they knew none of it was true. At the time, they knew none of it was true. Yeah, Saddam Hussein has longstanding, direct, and continuing ties to terrorist networks. Senior, says George W. Bush, and yet Fox News, Chris Wallace. So you're making a link there that the president never made. And people wonder why they call it faux news. As in F-A-U-X. Amazing. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
Well, I guess Chris Wallace is no Mike Wallace, is he?
Yeah, to say the very least.
Just like George W. is no George Herbert Walker, and I never thought I'd praise the old man, but...
Well, the old man actually had a sense, you know, I'm not with him politically, and I think that he did a lot of harm to this country, but at least he had, I think, he had a coherent belief system and philosophical, you know, he was a classic Republican, let's say.
He's beginning to look like Winston Churchill compared to his son.
Yeah, well,
but anyway,
tragically, that's not so hard.
I was also quite impressed with that information on John Adams. I didn't realize he was that much of a... Well, I'll use the letters, S-O-B.
Oh, it was worse than that. There was a guy, Luther Baldwin was his name, who was an alcoholic. And he was in a bar in, it's been a while since I wrote this story. I'm trying to remember. I think it was Dover. Yeah, it was Dover, Delaware. And John Adams had a standing rule. Whenever his carriage came through town, they had to line up and shoot the cannons, and all the local militia had to, you know, in unison shout, you know, long live President John Adams.
Oh, my God.
And so he's going through town, and they fire off the cannons, and Luther Baldwin is in this bar, and what he doesn't know is that the bar is owned by a Federalist, a guy who's a member of John Adams' party. And this was after the passage of the Alien Sedition Acts. And Luther Baldwin says, "Ah, they're firing the cannons. I don't care if they fire one into his arse." This was, you know, what Luther Baldwin said. And so the bar owner had him turned in, and Luther Baldwin spent the next year and a half in prison for speaking out against John Adams while he was drunk.
Huh. Well, the reason I called, Tom, is one of the local radio hosts here, who shall remain nameless, on one of our local GR stations, has called Ramsey Clark a traitor. Now, I'm kind of on the fence about this. I know technically he wouldn't be a traitor, but in fact, do you think a former attorney general of the United States has any business trying to be on Saddam Hussein's defense team?
I think it's unseemly. I understand that Ramsey Clark's point is that you know, we didn't legally depose Saddam Hussein.
No.
You know, but no, I think he's making a big mistake, frankly. Ramsey Clark is also the guy who put together the articles of impeachment against Bush.
Well, that's okay.
And he had some juice there. He had some credibility. I think that he's, you know, just purely from a public relations point of view, I think he's hurting himself quite badly.
Yeah, I think the thing that really should come out of this trial, and it probably never will, is how much complicity the United States had with the Saddam regime. And like I've tried to tell people, unless we remain neutral, which we probably should have done regarding the Iran-Iraq war,
mm-hmm.
People don't want to hear this maybe, but the facts are the facts. Actually, at the time, and maybe even now, Iraq, when I say even now, I mean, you know, when he was still in power there before he was deposed, I'd have to say he was the lesser of two evils between he and Iraq, wouldn't you?
He and Iran, you mean?
Oh, excuse me, yeah. But, in other words, what Saddam
yeah.
was saying, as bad as he was, was he worse than the Iranian mullahs?
In my opinion, no. And but see, I mean, nothing is black and white here, Rick. It is very interesting that before before we invaded Iraq, you had a situation where democracy was actually gaining a strong toehold in Iran.
Really?
Absolutely. You had a democratically elected parliament. You had a democratically elected president. They were passing laws that contradicted what the mullahs wanted. The problem is that in Iran, there is a provision in the Constitution which says that there is the equivalent of a Supreme Court,
right,
and that Supreme Court is made up of mullahs.
Sure.
And they can, for whatever reason, you know, whatever religious reason, they can veto any legislation. So there were all these democratic reforms that were being passed. This was six years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago. All these democratic reforms that were being passed, a lot of liberalization that was happening in Iran. And the mullahs were stopping it. And there was strong popular opposition to this. I mean, Iran was on the edge of becoming a democratic state and on the edge of there being a revolt against the mullahs.
Well, except
and when and when we invaded Iraq, all that fell apart.
Sure.
Actually, it wasn't even just invading Iraq. It was also when John Bolton, you can even go back from that. It was when George W. Bush labeled Iran as part of the Axis of Evil. That was the turning point. That was the point at which the people inside Iran who were working for more democracy suddenly found themselves, hanging out on a limb that had just been sawed off away from them. They could no longer speak of democracy because we're associated with that.
Right, but I do think that President Khatami, who may have been by Iranian standards a moderate, he was practically a figurehead because of that Ayatollah Khamenei, I believe is his name.
Right, Khamenei, yeah.
Could veto everything that Khatami...
That's right, because he was the head of the Supreme Court. But here's where it gets really weird. The Iraqi constitution that has been proposed has the same kind of Supreme Court built into it.
Right, and what we're going to wind up with maybe is Iran and Iraq, both Islamic republics, perhaps.
That's right. That's right.
Worse than before.
That's one possible outcome. The other possible outcome is that we'll go back with Iraq. We'll go back to, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB.
Right.
That is, we put Saddam Hussein into place and into power, and we kept him there in power because he was secular, because he was not, towing the line of the religious, and that's why
exactly.
We kept him there as long as we did, why Don Rumsfeld went over, shook his hand, why we sold him poison gas, why we sold him weapons of mass destruction, why we aided him in the war against Iran, while at the same time we were also, playing both ends against the middle. We were giving intelligence to Iran, but anyhow. Yeah, Rick, with regard to Ramsey Clark, just to bring this back to your original point, I think he's making a strategic mistake.
Probably, but he probably doesn't care.
No, he's a man of principle, and he believes that principles are on his side. Frankly, I think they may well be, but it's a sufficiently complex thing that it's like John Kerry trying to explain why he voted for the war when he really didn't mean to be voting for a war.
Sure.
Because he really didn't vote for the war. He voted to, the whole story, but in any case.
It's still a little too nuanced for most people.
Yep, it really is. Rick, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I was just wondering if you noticed that their foreign policy, the Republican foreign policy, is basically espousing a bunch of liberal values. It just seems like they're talking about helping people who were in the domestic front. They don't want people to be they want people to be helping themselves.
Well, yes and no. If you look at the way that we rewrote the Iraqi constitution, we made unions illegal. We threw open their borders to any kind of corporate activity. We made it possible for any corporation to come in, buy up Iraqi companies, take all the profits out of the country, that cheap labor could be brought in from other countries, without having to go through any kind of a visa permit, without any limits. So we basically tried to recreate Iraq as a neoconservative paradise, and that's the main thing that the Iraqis are fighting against.
Yeah, and the jargon they use. But I just wanted, when leading up to the war, when they were talking about the intelligence, we had intelligence. We knew that what they were saying were false, but the Republicans implied they had extra intelligence.
Right.
And now,
yeah.
Now they're saying that we had the same.
I know it's bogus, Logan. And thanks a lot for the call and pointing it out. I appreciate it. It's bogus, and people are waking up to it. I mean, there's a reason why there were more people in the streets of the world. More people went out and demonstrated than ever before in the history of the planet against our invading Iraq. And the reason was that we were all looking at the intelligence. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. Fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October sky.
And welcome back. Yeah, you tell them, man. Well, it's November, December. It's getting winter is coming. It's upon us here. Welcome back, friends. It is Cyber Monday. Is that what they're calling it now? It's we had Black Friday, the day of everybody hits the retailers. Today is supposed to be the day that everybody is hitting online sites to do their Christmas shopping. And we'll see. But in the meantime, interesting story in today's Wall Street Journal that highlights something that I have been ranting about for a long, long time. An article by Ian McDonald in the front of the first section of the paper here. Cash-rich American companies are showering a record windfall on their shareholders and in the process stirring some concern about your future growth of the U.S. economy. This is in the Wall Street Journal. They're talking about how basically what's happened is that in 2003, the Bush administration succeeded in pushing through a series of tax cuts, which included one that said, if you earn your living, if the check that you get every month in the mail or every quarter or every year or whatever, if the checks that you get in the mail by which you live come as a result of the labor of your mind or your body, then you have to pay taxes that go up into the 30% range. But if, like the members of the Bush family, for example, or many of the millionaires, multimillionaires in Congress, their families, the billionaires of the Bill Frist family and so on, if you earn your living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, you pay a maximum income tax rate of 15%. Because that's a superior type of work. Right, it's people who earn their living, sitting around waiting for the dividend check. That's, more important. So they only pay 15% tax, and they don't have to pay any of that nasty Social Security junk. Well, the problem is that tax cut expires in 2008, and Bush so far has not been able to get it renewed, although he's working on it. And so companies now are facing incredible pressure from their stockholders, particularly the very large wealthy ones who make the people, you look at what the top 100th of 1% of American income earners, as it were, people who earn more than $1.5 million a year. There's 14,000 families in that category in the United States. And saying, hey, we can have an income, maximum income tax of only 15% from now until 2008. We want every company in the country to just squeeze out every drop they've got and give it to us. Well, as the Wall Street Journal notes, dividends have been on the rise since the Bush administration succeeded in cutting the tax rate on them to 15% in 2003, as opposed to taxing dividends as regular income. And then they talk about how, the companies, currently U.S. companies, are sitting on near record levels of cash, and they're paying that out. Some economists call the payouts this year, quoting now from the Wall Street Journal, some economists call the payouts this year an ominous development that may be stealing from future economic growth. Now, why would that be? Well, because companies, instead of developing new products, opening new marketplaces, opening new stores, paying their workers more, which, by the way, is the most effective way to stimulate economic growth because the workers spend all that money. Instead of doing that, they're paying out. Well, here, let me quote Milton Erzadi, the chief economist at Lord Abbott Funds in Jersey City, New Jersey. He says in the Wall Street Journal today, he says, quote, these payments keep the economy growing more slowly because that money isn't flowing into capital spending. If businesses are giving up on innovation, we have problems. Bingo. And, there's a lot of people concerned about this. There's a chart in here, keeping profits close at hand. Corporate profits have soared. Quarterly profits earned by companies in the S&P up. But capital spending has not soared. Capital spending is actually down from what it was in 2001. That's capital spending, money invested in new stuff. So, anyhow. 1-866-440-THOM. Stuart in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. You were talking about two problems with our current electoral system, one of them being the Diebold electronic voting machines that can record whatever votes Wally O'Dell, the owner of Diebold, wants. And
well, and
no
let's
way...
not just pick on Diebold. I mean, there's several companies
Diebold,
that have got their
Sequoia,
fingers in this pot.
And all of the other electronic voting machine companies, that the main problem is somebody can program it to have the votes come out whatever way they want, and someone can have the votes changed after someone voted, and there's no way to verify that the votes that were recorded are as the voter intended. But that and the third parties, which can split the vote, the Greens and the Independents, those are not the biggest problems in our electoral system. The biggest problem with our electoral system is the single-member plurality rule system. Single-member meaning every district has one person who's supposed to represent everybody in the district. You can't have one person represent...
You're talking about congressional districts?
What?
You're talking about congressional districts?
Congressional districts, right. Or Senate, or...
Well, you have two... Each state has two senators, so...
Yes, but the senator is supposed to represent... There's one election for a senator at a time. That one senator is supposed to represent everybody in the state.
Right. I take it, Stuart, you're arguing in favor of proportional representation.
I'm arguing in favor of proportional representation.
Yeah. Here's the problem with proportional representation. I'm sorry to be short about this, but we have about a minute left, is that the system that we have is built into our Constitution. If you're going to have proportional representation in the United States, you're going to have a constitutional convention and modify
yes,
the Constitution.
We need a constitutional
and
convention.
I would not trust that to happen right now with so much corporate power in the hands, you know, being exercised on our politicians. If we opened the Constitution to an easy amendment and easy rewrite, I fear that we would be left with nothing.
Yeah, well, we need a revolution.
Yeah, that's, you know, it sounds nice, Stuart, but I don't think that's going to happen either. Stuart,
okay,
thanks
thank
a lot
you.
For the call. I appreciate it. Now, I think instant runoff voting is actually the very simple solution for this. And the Green Party is right out there pushing for it and doing a very, very good job, aggressively pushing for that kind of electoral reform. And it's something that I think would do a really fine job. It's worked fine in Australia. It works fine in New Zealand. Why not here? I'm Tom Hartman, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you on the place where smart people get their news. Speaking of smart people, Jeffrey Feldman is with us. Frameshopisopen.com, his website. Jeffrey, last time you were on, a few people sent me an email going, I went to frameshop.com and it's a porn site. I'm like, no, it's frameshopisopen.com, right?
Yeah, when I first started the website, I had been posting on the Daily Kos, a large political blog before that, and apparently somebody bought that frameshop URL and directed it to a porn site. So make sure people go to frameshopisopen.com.
Right, frameshopisopen.com is the website. And Jeffrey Feldman, one of the world's leading experts on framing and framing language. And Jeffrey, at least in my opinion, you are. And you're one of your more recent articles, you're writing about how Vice President Cheney, Dick Cheney, is out there recycling Frank Luntz's 2004 presidential election frame.
That's right. During the election, Frank Luntz had circulated a memo, Luntz being the framing guru from the Republicans who runs a consulting firm called Luntz Strategies. And in this memo, it listed a core set of rules that all Republicans should follow when talking about issues during the last election. And amongst the first was always tie everything to 9/11. Just about everything that the Republicans talked about at that time had to do with 9/11. And last week, as the chips were down for the administration, they reached back to that strategy. Vice President Cheney gave a speech to the American Enterprise Institute, which is one of these organizations that the vice president can walk down the street to in D.C. and give a speech, photo op when he needs to. And he once again linked everything back to Iraq, but he did it in a very, very interesting new logic. Before the war, the administration used Iraq as the logic for why we need used 9/11 as the logic for why we needed to go into Iraq, but now the vice president was saying that we needed to stay in Iraq because of 9/11, that 9/11 was somehow evidence for the reason why we needed to stay there. So it was a nice little twist on logic that they had used before.
It's sort of reversing time. It's a time reverse.
Exactly. And this time, rather than using 9/11 as the reason why we needed to go in there, Cheney was saying that the fact that we were not in Iraq before 9/11 was evidence that there was terrorists in 9/11 beforehand, because the Democrats had been using the argument that the American policy in Iraq was causing more terrorism, and so now Cheney had shifted this basic Luntz principle in order to respond to that.
So
very crafty.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's pretty slick. So the appropriate response for the Democrats to this frame that first of all, is the frame working for Cheney?
I don't think that frame worked. It's very interesting what happened over the weekend, because we had a lot of silence coming out of the White House over Thanksgiving. It was very conspicuous. They didn't put out any announcements. They didn't list anything to their website. They were very, very quiet. And so my sense is that they were waiting for something to happen. And what I think they were waiting for was a poll to come out from RT Strategies. So RT Strategies is a Democratic poll. It's typically a poll that favors Democrats in its findings. And they put out a study that they actually did a few days before Cheney's speech, which said that the Democratic criticism of the war, it asked people if Democratic criticism of the war is hurting troop morale. And a large percentage of their respondents said that it was. So I believe that one of the things that the Cheney was doing, or that the Republicans are doing, was waiting to see how to play this, how to spin their political misfortune coming out of the Thanksgiving debate. And it seems that what we're going to find is a lot more ads branding Democrats as turncoats or traitors in the way that we saw again during the campaign against Kerry.
Right. In other words, you're by speaking out, you're harming our troops, you're harming the morale of the troops, and that's the terrible thing, and, you know, et cetera.
Exactly. And so the thing that the Democrats need to be careful of is backing right into that particular frame, the idea that criticizing the policy is a direct affront to the soldiers in Iraq.
But, you know, I mean, this goes literally, we were talking in the last segment, we were talking about John Adams. I mean, this goes all the way back to the founding of the country. John Adams actually got a law passed that said that if you criticized John Adams as president, you were criticizing the government itself, and that was an act of sedition. That was an act that was punishable by imprisonment. And he actually got that passed through Congress by one vote, but he got it passed, and there were a lot of, you know, the Federalist Party, which I would say argue has been reincarnated as the Republican Party, was all in favor of that. So, I mean, this is something that has a long history. It's a very subtle thing, I think, for Joe Sixpack, or even for the average American, even the average American college graduate who isn't much paying attention to politics, to say, yes, these guys are over there these men and women are over there fighting for our right to dissent. Therefore, dissent should make them even more enthusiastic about their battle, if you know what I mean.
I do. It's a tough argument to get out in a few words. And I think that the White House attack of the Democrats for hurting the troops is going to be effective in the short run. And I think that the way to counteract that type of framing of the issues is to find a way to have soldiers in Iraq speak for themselves. One of the things that the vice president is doing when he gives these types of speeches is he's presuming to speak for all the soldiers in Iraq. And we know from experience that there's an incredible amount of political debate that goes on over there amongst our soldiers. And there's quite a number of soldiers, both who have come back recently and who are on the ground over there, who are very much in support of the critique of the policy. This morning, I had a blog interaction with Cindy Sheehan, of all people, in which I asked her how people should respond to these accusations that the Democratic critiques are hurting the troops. And she responded by giving me a quote from a soldier who she was in contact with, who said that they think that the vice president is wrong, and that people should continue their criticisms of the war, which is without direction. They're not sure what they're supposed to be doing over there. They're doing their best. So. Listening to the soldiers is a good way to counteract that frame.
Yeah, I would think another way to counteract that frame would be to just come right out and bluntly say, Mr. Cheney, you're the one putting the soldiers at risk here.
Exactly.
It's got nothing to do with our words. It's got to do with your strategy of flypaper. You know, let them, you know, let's fight them so that we don't have to fight them here, or let's draw them into battle there. I mean, you're using our soldiers as sacrificial goats.
Exactly, and the whole strategy is to get, in theory, to have a war that lures terrorists onto a common ground. That notion that our soldiers are bait is also a powerful idea.
Yeah. Now, I noticed on frameshopisopen.com, we're speaking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief of frameshopisopen.com, your discussion about new beginnings versus responsibility. Tell us about these frames.
Well, one very interesting development that's happened in the past week, in particular since Sunday, is that there seem to be two very clear Democratic positions on the war. The first we're familiar with from last week, John Murtha and Russ Feingold, who are talking about the idea that the war policy is over, that it's time to end the current strategy that the White House is pursuing and start something new. This idea, first from Feingold, then from Murtha, is what I call a frame of new beginnings. By contrast, on Sunday, Senator Biden was on TV and gave an interview, and he once again put forward this argument about responsibility. Rather than saying that the policy was a mistake to support the policy, that we need to end this mission and take stock about what we need to do next, he's calling for the president to issue a plan. He wants the president to take responsibility and tell us what to do next. And
which implicitly defines the president as irresponsible.
That's right. It defines the president as irresponsible. Exactly. But the problem, I think, with the Biden position is that it lacks the clarity that the public wants and demands on the issue of Iraq.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, just having the president become responsible is also sort of a variation on asking the president for an apology. It doesn't get our troops out of there.
Exactly, and a lot of people are looking at that particular approach as one which is servicing political ambitions on the part of the Democrats.
Right, so Biden's positioning himself to run for president rather than trying to get the troops out.
Exactly, and when you think about, you know, the voices in the Democratic Party that have had absolute clarity on these issues, you know, Dean had absolute clarity in the last campaign, Feingold and Murtha have it now, and when they state those clear positions, they dominate the debate and they give the public the leadership that they're looking for. So I think it's really, really vital for Democrats, Americans in general, to grab on to a position of clarity in Iraq and then worry about the subtleties in the policy at a later stage.
So the main frames the Democrats should be putting forward now are let the troops speak for themselves, stop having our troops be bait or whatever, you know, get the bullseye off the troops' back, and this idea of a new beginning. Let's redefine our mission out of harm's way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like that's what you're saying. Great. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you, as always. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program, 866-440-8466. We'll be back right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Victoria Jones is with us from Washington, D.C. with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much indeed. Yes, it's a fairly quiet week in Washington, D.C. The president's out of town. Congress is out. Supreme Court is issuing rulings and having bits of the building drop off and fall, not on people, but just bits of the building fell off this morning.
Literally?
Literally fell off, yes, yes.
It's symbolic of what's happening. Bush is taking apart the Supreme Court, and sure enough, it's being taken apart.
I wonder what you do with it, and you went for it. I'm so glad.
Yeah, amazing. It's amazing.
The one story story that I'm noticing is being followed overseas that did get some traction initially and then suddenly has disappeared here is the story about the U.S. troops who burned corpses of two their suspected Taliban fighters. They were killed in a gun battle in Afghanistan. So this wasn't Iraq, and of course Afghanistan's no longer news. And this was considered extremely insulting to Islam because you don't burn bodies in Islam. And it turns out that they've decided that there are going to be no criminal charges, according to military investigators. They were burned for hygiene reasons and also using the cremation to taunt other fighters.
Mm. So it was just part of war.
Right, and so I'm trying to decide, so if it's hygiene, what, so it was just convenient that there were some bodies to burn hygienically that they could taunt people with, or they were burning them and thought, well, let's do a bit of taunting anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very interesting, but it's getting almost no coverage here in the U.S.
You know, the larger issue that this brings up about Afghanistan is that when we first went into Afghanistan, there was only, as I recall, there was only one member of Congress who voted against that, or at least in the Senate anyway.
And
you know, there was a broad consensus that 9/11 seemed to have been perpetrated by a guy who was hanging out in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden, and that, you know, Afghanistan offered to give him up to the international community for trial, but they refused to give him up to the United States. And so, you know, we took that personally. And so there was pretty broad support for invading Afghanistan and getting Osama bin Laden. And we invaded Afghanistan, and we chased Osama bin Laden around. And then all of a sudden, George gets this burr under his saddle and decides to go off in some other direction to take down Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And bin Laden is, you know, I'm of the opinion he's been dead for 3 years, but the official status of bin Laden is that he's still running around loose. You know, here's a 6'6" guy on a camel with a dialysis machine, and we can't find him. And now what we're hearing, the story that we're hearing out of Afghanistan, is that the country is starting to disintegrate. Karzai is basically the mayor of Kabul, and that's it. And that even that's becoming tenuous.
It's really very disturbing. And you say, you know, now that's what we're hearing, but you really have to go and dig to hear it, because it's just not being reported. And I'm not going to major blame the U.S. media. They have reported some things, and the politicians seem to have no interest, or at least the administration seems to have no interest in Afghanistan falling apart. It is fascinating that at a time when we're claiming that we've got, well, first of all, we claimed we have victory in Afghanistan because we liberated it, but now we've got victory in Iraq. So if you turn your back on one, does the next one fall down?
Yeah. Well, my guess is that before the 2006 elections, if the Republicans want to pull the fat out of the fire at all, I mean, and this is their only possibility to save their butts with this coming election, they're going to have to declare victory in both countries and essentially get out. And I mean, we've already done that for all practical purposes in Afghanistan. The warlords now run the country. Afghanistan last year produced the largest crop of opium/morphine/heroin in the history of the world. And, you know, and it's being sold out there in the open market. In fact, it's creating a terrible situation in Europe. You've got European countries that are begging America and Great Britain to do something about it, because heroin that was selling for, you know, $15-$20 a dose on the streets is now down to $3-$5 a dose. It's so cheap that it's you know, a lot of people getting addicted to it. They're mixing the stuff with tobacco and smoking it now. It's a terrible, terrible problem as a result of our Afghan policy. So.
And something that, you know, in theory we took into account ahead of time, we all knew that this is where poppy grew. You know, it wasn't like this was a secret. We knew that, and most of us had seen Traffic. Oh, well, actually, the original Traffic was set in Pakistan, Afghanistan, not the new one. But it you hear from Afghan farmers, they all make the point very clearly, you can't pay us enough to grow something else.
Yeah.
You know, if you can find a way for us to make a living, they say, then fine, we'll stop growing this stuff. But you haven't come up with anything.
Yeah. So maybe we should simply start buying all of our pharmaceutical opium from Afghanistan.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it seems pretty straightforward because, you know, we do use a lot of pharmaceutical opium. Problem is, most of it's grown right now in New Zealand, and I don't think New Zealand's going to be very happy about that.
No, I shouldn't think they are, but New Zealand's not on the point of imploding, so they.
That's right, and they're not going to become a terrorist state if they can't grow poppies
exactly.
any longer. So it's interesting, you know, how this stuff all spins around. Victoria Jones, good talking with you. Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria. We'll talk to you tomorrow. 27 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. What is Tom DeLay up to? I'll tell you about that right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, the pity on working man.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 before the hour. However you want to view that. Tom DeLay is getting ready to come back to power. Yeah, actually last week he thought that there was a chance that this Texas judge, you'll recall the first couple of judges he got thrown out because they had been Democrats. So, and, you know, a Democrat in Texas is pretty conservative to begin with. But in any case, he got the first couple of judges thrown out. They finally dragged some poor guy out of retirement. And propped him up, and he says, "Okay, I'll be the judge." And DeLay thought, "Okay, I got it. We got this thing nailed. You know, we got our own judge." And so they brought forward a motion to dismiss the case. Just throw the whole thing out. And Tom DeLay, it turns out, had actually written a letter to the chairman of the House Republican Conference, or the chairwoman, Deborah Price of Ohio. Telling her that, hey, I'm all set to come back. I just got the charges dismissed, and I'm ready to be in charge of the Republicans again. Well, two things happened. First was the judge said, he looked at DeLay's motion for dismissal, and he said, you know, I don't think so. We're not going to do this. We're going to have a trial on this. Looks to me like maybe a crime was committed here. So, first off, DeLay did not succeed in getting the charges dismissed, so his letter to Deborah Price didn't go any farther than his word processor, apparently. And secondly, Denny Hastert was supposed to, you know, he was supposed to be all ready to go out there and say, yeah, we're all there. We're there with you, Tom. Except for the fact that Michael Scanlon, who used to be Tom DeLay's mouthpiece, his official spokesman, has just pled guilty to, you know, a series of crimes involving Jack Abramoff, who is in the middle of this mess that may involve a murder, that may involve bribery, that could involve, I mean, it's just a terrible mess. And it looks like Tom DeLay is right in the smack dab in the middle of this thing. This could be the biggest scandal in Congress in history. I mean, you want to go back to I believe it was Coolidge, it was Teapot Dome, wasn't that Calvin Coolidge's administration? I believe so. The Teapot Dome scandal was when Albert I forget which. He was the, as I recall, the Secretary of the Interior, and he had responsibility for some land in Wyoming, oddly enough, Dick Cheney's home, that was called Teapot Dome and had oil under it. And they were going to, sort of like with Anwar, you know, they were going to give that oil to a private company. And good old Albert, anyway, takes this is all, I'm running from memory here, and it's been 20 years since I read the story. So, but check it out. You Google it on the web. I'm sure you'll find it fascinating. Fell takes a bribe, and my recollection is it was like $100,000 or $150,000, which is big money back then. And, it was a huge scandal. Well, this could be even bigger than Teapot Dome. This could be absolutely huge. And so there's a lot of Republicans who are sitting around going, Tom, you know, we're all with you. We love you, Tom. Yep, no problem. And then as soon as he turns his back, they're going, we got to get rid of this guy. This guy's nuts. He inhaled too much bug killer back when he was a pesticide purveyor. And now you got Congressman Duke Cunningham pleading guilty, the Republican who's, you know, the yacht-living Republican. Scotty McClellan, 19 days since he gave an on-the-record press briefing. PR Week says Scott McClellan is going to be toast. He just, I mean, you know, at a certain point, you hit the point that the, you know, our former Secretary of the Treasury hit, that our former Secretary of the EPA hit. You hit that point where you just can't make the lies work anymore. You just can't make the spin work anymore, and you got to say, I'm packing it in. And it looks like maybe Scotty's going to do that. We'll see. Time will tell. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, and TomHartmann.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, see what that's all about. Bob in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting show.
Thank you.
One thing that I've wondered about is if the Democrats could, you were talking about framing the issues.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. I'm just an ordinary guy. I don't know if we should get out of Iraq or what we should do next. Should we go to... But I sure would like to see some competence.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if the why the Democrats can't frame this as an issue of competence.
Yeah, that's a good one.
People in there that know how to fight this war.
Bob. I don't know if you're. Are you still there, Bob?
Yes, I am.
I absolutely agree with you. The Democrats, in fact, started to frame this as an issue of competence a few weeks ago, and I thought that was a frame that was getting some traction, and particularly after Katrina, it would have been a very, very powerful frame. But they lost it. And good point. And I hope they come back to it. Thanks a lot, Bob, for the call. Good to hear from you, David and Blaine Washington on the line. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, love your show. Listen to it every day. I tell everybody about you.
Well, thank you.
Some Dems have already framed it, you know, and I'm so sick of hearing, you know, this generalization that Democrats aren't doing anything or they don't have any spine. There's Sheila Jackson Lee, there's Barbara Boxer, you know, you name it.
Sure.
Feingold. Anyways.
Yeah.
So I wanted to refresh the memory of your listeners that it was the day before Thanksgiving. Maybe you can help me out with this. In 2003, remember when Howard Dean was starting to become real critical of Bush and Iraq, and
right.
all of a sudden
Saddam pops out of his hole.
Saddam Hussein out of the hole, and then the media spotlight shifted.
Right, and interestingly, you had the Kurdish soldiers who said that they had captured him coming forward and saying that he had been captured 3 weeks earlier, that they had been holding him hostage for these 3 weeks.
That's right.
You know, the whole thing.
They're
and
so full of crap.
Yeah, well, or whatever, and the story just that story died. Although those guys are still around and they're still saying it, this administration has gotten very, very good at simply saying, you know, this is our story and we're sticking to it. You know, it's so you just don't know. David, thanks for sensitizing people to that. In fact, I'll even take it a step beyond that, David. Howard Dean. Let's back up just a little bit. You have to understand how the Republicans think about this kind of stuff. I mean, they're playing chess, not checkers, and they're playing deadly keeps. I mean, you know, they're playing for keeps because their mission, their goal is not what's necessarily best for the country. It's what's best for them. It's what's best for their friends. How do they make the most money off this? How can they exploit this thing? How can the rich get richer kind of thing? And so, for example, when Richard Nixon... Nixon, they did the polling, as both Republicans and Democrats do. They did the polling, and they found that Ed Muskie would beat Richard Nixon. Ed Muskie was a strong guy, the senator from Maine. He was strong, outspoken, tall, rugged, good looks, great speaking voice. He had the persona. I mean, he could have been a Ronald Reagan kind of president, in as much as Reagan knew how to act the role of being president. He looked presidential. He behaved presidential. So did Ed Muskie. Edmund Muskie, the Republican polling turned out, could have easily beaten Richard Nixon. George McGovern couldn't beat him. And so what do? They send Chuck Colson and his merry band, the Dirty Tricksters, up to New Hampshire to steal some of Muskie's letterhead and forge the Canuck letter, you know, a racial slur against French people of French ancestry, which is about a third of the population in New Hampshire. And the right-wing newspaper up there, the Manchester Union Leader, picks it up and runs it, a front-page editorial by William Loeb, who now deceased. His wife, Naki, I believe, is still around running that newspaper. And And there are some reports that they put LSD or something similar to it into Muskie's coffee. And Muskie gets up on the back of this flatbed truck, and he's being attacked in the media. He's being attacked in the newspaper. He's got all these folks ganging up on him. There's these obvious lies out there. And apparently he's tripping his brains out because he starts blubbering about his wife. And that's the end of it. I mean, that's the end of his career. So they decided that they didn't want to run against Muskie. And so they took him out in the primaries. They took out the Democrat that could beat them in the primaries. I am to this day of the opinion that Howard Dean could have easily beaten George W. Bush, could have easily beaten George W. Bush. And you go back and you look at Iowa, and not only did the timing of Saddam's capture help Bush versus Dean, help bounce Dean out of the news, but there was only one Democratic candidate the Republicans spent any money trying to defeat in the Iowa primaries. And they spent more than $1 million, which is an enormous amount of money in a little state like Iowa. $1 million was spent running those ads where they said, you know, send Howard Dean back to Vermont. We don't want any latte drinking, Volvo driving liberals here. And I lived in Vermont at the time. And I'll tell you, people in Vermont, by and large, don't drink lattes and don't drive Volvos. Mostly they drink, you know, coffee from 7-Eleven and drive pickup trucks with shotguns in the back. It's a very rural state. But they ran these ads. $1 million the Republicans spent to knock Dean out of the race. And I'm convinced that they had some success. And then Dean, in my opinion, made the mistake of telling Chris Matthews the truth. Matthews said, what are you going to do about the media? And Dean said, we need to break up some of these big media monopolies. And Matthews was like, wait a minute, you mean General Electric, which owns this network, is going to have to divest itself of its network? And Dean was like, yeah. And that was literally the last day. I remember I turned to Louise. We were watching that, and I said, that's it. Howard Dean is not going to get any more positive media coverage. And it was like a switch had been flipped. The next day, they were calling him crazy. So, anyhow, that's my rant. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of members of Congress apparently in the hospital in Baghdad. Don't know if you caught this. A military vehicle, this from the Associated Press, carrying U.S. politicians, overturned on the way to the Baghdad airport on Saturday, injuring two members of Congress, says Congressman Jim Marshall. Representative Tim Murphy, Republican of Pennsylvania, was airlifted to a military hospital in Germany for an MRI on his neck. And Representative Ike Skelton, a Democrat from Missouri, was sent to a Baghdad hospital. Murphy is bumped and bruised but in good spirits, said his chief of staff. He will return home from Germany as soon as he's cleared by the doctors. Spokeswoman for Skelton, Lara Bottles, confirmed that the vehicle accident was reported and said it was her understanding that Skelton was okay. Interesting. Marshall, a Georgia Democrat, was not hurt. The congressional delegation was riding in a box-like vehicle, the troops called the ice cream truck, that streaked through the middle of the road to deter oncoming motorists, Marshall said. But shortly after dark, an oncoming truck refused to yield. The stories that I've heard is that this was one of the contractors, you know, pulling a fuel truck. Marshall says, then all of a sudden the brakes slammed on, then we hit something, go off the side of the road and tip over. Marshall said as the vehicle toppled over, he held on to Skelton, who has limited use of his arms due to a bout with childhood polio. He said, everyone sort of fell over to the side. There's no cushion to it. It's all solid metal with bolts sticking out. I feel like a fool. I didn't put my seatbelt on. The accident reminded Marshall of his first group to Iraq with Skelton when Marshall voiced concerns on the dangers of high-speed driving strategies aimed at getting dignitaries safely through treacherous territory. It's so odd to me, he said. I said, shoot, this is more important. This is more dangerous than the terrorists. And dang if we didn't flip over. So keep track of that and find out what's going on. I don't know. Did you see the Doonesbury cartoon this weekend? Against torture? Doonesbury, this is fascinating that the first cartoon that Gary Trudeau ever had published, Gary Trudeau, of course, the artist and author, whatever, creator, genius behind Doonesbury, The first cartoon Gary Trudeau ever created was when he was a student at Yale. At the same time that George W. Bush was a student at Yale, George W. Bush was head of the Deke fraternity, the DKE fraternity, and they were branding their fraternity members, beating them and branding them. And the first cartoon that Gary Trudeau ever did was about George W. Bush branding people. Right? This is pretty amazing. In fact, from 1967, the New York Times, Boston lawyer Franklin Levy said, to increase the fear of the moment, the older fraternity men, this would be George W. Bush, he was the head of the fraternity at the time, first brandished an actual glowing iron, branding iron, red hot, to make them think that's what awaited them. When they burned me, Levy remembers, I jumped a mile. Before the brandings, pledges had to endure hours of being kicked and a vicious round of tannings with wooden paddles, another practice that Yale has since ruled taboo. On that night, according to an account in the Yale Daily News in 1967, each pledge was forced to sit with his head between his legs, motionless, for 2 to 5 hours. If he coughed, raised his hand, or talked, he was kicked by an older brother. After all the beatings, recalled one fraternity member, the branding was almost a relief. In the wake of the Yale Daily News' expose of the fraternity's hazing, Bush, whose father was also a DKE at Yale, admitted the branding to the New York Times in November 1967, but Bush, whose college nickname was Lip for his Texas wisecracks, also ripped into Yale for being too haughty to allow this type of pledging to go on. Yeah. Lee still bears the mark 32 years later. He has the brand. He doesn't know who actually branded him. He said, but I do know that George Bush was very active in all the fraternity activities then. He doesn't know who branded him because he was not allowed to look. Bush at the time insisted that it only left a scar that was like a cigarette burn, which, quote, left no scarring mark physically or mentally, end quote. So apparently torture has a long history in the life experience of George W. Bush. Very, very strange. I mean, very, very strange. 1-866-440-THOM. We have just about a minute left. Randall in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Well, back to the issue and the debate of maybe about the president's misconduct. I hold him and find him, and this would be an asterisk in all this debate we have going, in neglect as commander-in-chief. In bringing about an undue and unjust action against Iraq.
Yes, he led us into an unnecessary war.
Well, there's more to this, because Captain Fishback goes to Murtha in press conference, I saw on C-SPAN, says that Murtha told him, said, we are in violation of the Geneva Convention rules. We go to lawyers, they say one thing. We go to higher command, they say another. And then Murtha says in that press conference, which I saw taped, was lucky enough, that Murtha then writes a letter to McCain. And in that letter, Murtha says this, Captain Fishback says, I had rather be dead, or rather not be alive, than to be engaged in this abuse of the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, I think that
trooper,
there are...
As an old trooper, don't get me confused with the speech that Colin Powell made when he says, an old trooper, these canisters look like, you know, spent rods.
Mm-hmm.
The old Energy Department had told him, later revealed, that those are probably canisters for munitions.
Yeah, his own State Department, for that matter.
Let's stay down the troop level here. Let's not go to Yale.
Yeah. Okay? No, you're absolutely right, Randall, and I appreciate you calling and you're making that point. Well said. George W. Bush lied us into a war that we didn't need to have, and he did it for political capital. And Cindy Sheehan outed him on that when she quoted him speaking to his biographer in 1999 as saying if he had a chance to invade Iraq, now this was before the 2000 election, he would use that political capital to get his political agenda, like privatizing Social Security, doing away with all his nasty socialist programs, and cutting taxes on the investor class, you know, his family and friends, through. And he did. Sure enough, what a surprise. 57 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy, efforts and courage are not enough without purpose and direction. Indeed. And what kind of purpose and direction are we heading in the United States? What kind of purpose and direction is the Democratic Party going to be pursuing? I mean, this is one of that I think is of considerable consequence. For example, Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, this from the Indianapolis Star, has racked up one of the largest tabs in Congress for privately paid travel during the past 5.5 years, writes Maureen Grope from the Star Washington Bureau. Outside interests have paid $169,227 to send Bayh and sometimes his wife around the world since 2000, the fourth highest amount in Congress. His trips to China cost over $40,000. Now, here's what I find particularly interesting. More than one-third of Bayh's trips since 2000 have been paid for by the Democratic Leadership Council. And then they refer to it as the moderate Democratic group that Bayh headed from 2001 through July of this year. Yeah, right, moderate. The DLC, what the DLC is all about is corporate power and politics. I'm sorry, they are the anti-progressive arm of the Democratic Party. And Evan Bayh is going to be running for president. His father, by the way, former Senator Birch Bayh, is a Washington lobbyist, recently hired by India. The Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry sent the Bayhs on a tour of India last year that cost $17,692, the second most expensive trip taken by anyone in Indiana's congressional delegation for the past decade. Senator Evan Bayh here. Voted with most senators in 2000 to make permanent China's standing as a normal U.S. trading partner, ignoring the fact that it's a communist dictatorship that routinely tortures its citizens. I mean, there's some serious issues here with regard to China that we just seem to be, it's no big deal. Meanwhile, radioactive tank number 9 comes limping home. You know, why are the Democrats not speaking of this? Actually, I'll get to that. I want to get to that in just a minute. First, the Defense Department. I saw on one of the weekend programs. I forget which one. One of the talking heads just kind of made this offhand comment that as the year goes on, one of the hottest topics that we're going to be hearing about, seeing, reading, whatever, is going to be spying inside the United States by the Army. And you say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't think the Army had the legal authority to spy inside the United States. Well, used to be they didn't. Used to be against the law. There's these laws called posse comitatus that were passed during Reconstruction in the 1870s, 1880s. And the posse comitatus law basically says that the military of the United States will never again be directed toward American citizens the way it was in the Civil War. So there's this absolute barrier that the if you're going to use the military, you have to use them against somebody other than American citizens. And now comes this story in the Washington Post this weekend by Walter Pincus. The Defense Department titled Pentagon Expanding Its Domestic Surveillance Activity. The Defense Department, the Defense Department, Don Rumsfeld, has expanded its programs aimed at gathering and analyzing intelligence within the United States, creating new agencies, adding personnel, and seeking additional legal authority for domestic security activities in the post-9/11 world. The moves have been taken place on several fronts, writes Pincus. The White House is considering expanding the power of a little-known Pentagon agency called the Counterintelligence Field Activity, or CIFA, C-I-F-A, which was created 3 years ago. The proposal made by a presidential commission would transform CIFA from an office that coordinates Pentagon security efforts, including protecting military facilities from attack, to one that also has authority to investigate crimes within the United States, such as treason, foreign or terrorist sabotage, or even economic sabotage. Now, economic crimes are defined under the Patriot Act, by the way, as crimes that can be considered terrorism. Which means, for example, that the folks who threw the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773, under the laws today, could be seized as enemy combatants and put into jail with Jose Padilla and said, you know, sorry, no trial, no judge, no jury, you're toast, see you in 3 years, solitary confinement. Maybe you get tortured, who knows? We might even ship you to Egypt. I mean, this is pretty startling. Just to boil the thing down, the Pentagon has pushed through legislation that would create an intelligence exception to the Privacy Act, allowing the FBI and others to share information gathered about you and me with the Pentagon, the CIA, and other intelligence agencies. Civil liberty advocates and a few members of Congress are suggesting that the Defense Department's push into domestic collection is moving ahead with, you know, no oversight by Congress. Nobody's paying attention to this. This is what happens with fascistic regimes. They just start, you know, these getting more and more power. It's amazing. I mean, this is the stuff that conservatives used to worry about. Where are they when you need them? Modifications were also made in the provision during allowing the FBI to share information with the Pentagon and the CIA, requiring the approval of the Director of National Intelligence, who's John Negroponte, for that to occur. John, Death Squad John, the guy we sent down to Honduras to be our ambassador, and all of a sudden in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Honduras, we've got death squads appearing. Right in the middle, all the death squad activity. Then, you know, he kind of goes into private business, and then we send him off to Iraq, and all of a sudden you got death squads in Iraq. Now he's in charge of all of our intelligence. He's the Director of National Intelligence. He's the boss of the guy who's the boss of the guy who's the boss of the guy of the boss of the guy who's monitoring this radio broadcast. And probably your phone calls. And your email. The data sharing amendment would still give the Pentagon greater access to the FBI's massive collection of data, including information on citizens not connected to terrorism or espionage. In other words, you and me. Spokesman for the Pentagon, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Conway, said that the most senior Defense Department intelligence officials are aware of the sensitivities related to their expanded domestic activities. He says, in the age of terrorism, the U.S. military and its facilities are targets, and we have to be prepared within our authorities to defend them before something happens. Why not then call the FBI? That's what they're there for. The FBI has the ability to do internal, inside the United States, espionage. That's its job. And if they can find there's evidence that somebody has committed a crime, they can get a warrant from a judge from the judicial branch, the FBI being part of the executive branch, they can get a warrant to break into somebody's house. This is all pre-Patriot Act. The Patriot Act, of course, says, no, you don't need, you know, we don't need those stinking, judicial branch. It's just the executive branch gets to run everything. NORTHCOM, the Northern Command, intelligence centers in Colorado and Texas. They're fusing reports from CIFA. This is this new agency, only 3 years old. Bush created this thing. The FBI and other U.S. agencies, 290 intelligence analysts, 200 analysts working for the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. This is even more than in the Department of Homeland Security. Every one of these military services has now started their own intelligence services. The Marine Corps has expanded its domestic intelligence operation, developed internal policies in 2004. The prime illustration of the Pentagon's intelligence effort is the CIFA program. Neither the size of its staff nor its budget is public. Right. It's amazing. When I was in school, you had to read George Orwell's 1984. I would submit to you that probably the vast majority of people under the age of 30 have never read 1984 and have no idea what I'm talking about when I say Big Brother is here. But I'm telling you, Big Brother's here. CIFA counterintelligence involves not just collecting data, but also conducting activities to protect the Department of Defense and the nation against espionage, other intelligence activities, sabotage, assassinations, and terrorist activities. End quote. Is it the end of posse comitatus? Is it the beginning of a police state? It sure does smell like it. You know, you get that kind of whiff of friendly fascism. Frankly, concerns me tremendously. And I know it concerns a lot of good, solid conservatives like Ron Paul. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way.
Ah, yes, the Universal
and he's
Soldier.
Fighting for democracy.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. At the bottom of the hour, by the way, we're going to have our best of the rest of the news segment. And it should be fascinating. We're going to get Laurie Wallach and David Sirota on and talk about what's been going on in the news, what you can see coming down the road. Just a few little miscellaneous anecdotes first, by the way. sometimes you just can't make this stuff up. U.S. Border Patrol uniforms made in Mexico. I'm not kidding you. The shirts and pants worn by agents and inspectors of U.S. Customs and Border Protection made in Mexico. They're supplied to the Army or to the Customs Service by a company called VF Solutions in Asheville, Tennessee. And VF Solutions subcontracts its work to plants in the U.S., Mexico, Canada, and the Dominican Republic. And the stuff that they make for the folks who are combating illegal immigration from Mexico has little labels in it. The olive green shirts and pants have little labels in them that say, made in Mexico. I kid you not. On the other hand, Andy Borowitz, Kim Jong-il acquires, well, here. This is from BorowitzReport.com. North Korean President Kim Jong-il stunned the world today by announcing that he had acquired the M&M balloon from this year's Macy's Thanksgiving parade and intended to add it to his deadly arsenal. At first glance, the M&M balloon, which hit a lamppost during the parade and injured two people, would seem a cut below the rest of Kim's lethal weaponry. But arms control experts are worried about what plans the North Korean madman might have for it. In particular, fears abound that Kim might attach a nuclear weapon to the balloon and send it floating over South Korea, where it could hit a lamppost and destroy the city of Seoul. Ambassador Chris Hill, the lead U.S. negotiator in the ongoing talks over North Korea's nuclear arsenal, expressed shock and dismay that Kim was able to acquire the deadly balloon so easily. At a time when we're trying to rein in the North Korean threat, the acquisition of the M&M balloon is not helpful, said Ambassador Hill. According to Dr. Davis Logsdon, director of Arms Control Research Center at the University of Minnesota, in 1997, Kim Jong-il tried to acquire a cat-in-the-hat balloon, which crashed into a lamppost during that year's Macy's parade. Fortunately, said Dr. Logsdon, that sale was thwarted. The idea of Kim Jong-il possessing both the M&M balloon and the cat-in-the-hat balloon is too terrifying to contemplate. Indeed. And I mentioned radioactive tank number 9, limping home. Across the plains of Kansas, destroyed radioactive Abrams tanks perched on railroad flat cars rolled toward an uncertain future. This from the sfbayview.com by Bob Nichols. Only one thing is certain, they'll be radioactive forever. These are Abrams tanks that are constructed with a layer of radioactive uranium metal plates. Yes, my friends, we have found a way to get rid of our nuclear waste. Not only do we turn it into bullets and bombs to drop on the Iraqis, we're also using it to armor plate our tanks, which are then returned to the United States for disposal. 140,000 pounds each. National Academy of Sciences report released at the end of June of this year. There is no such thing as a safe level of radiation. All radiation is bad. However, the Army says, no problem. You don't have to worry about this stuff. radioactive tanks coming back. In addition, the U.S. military has distributed an estimated 8 million pounds of weaponized ceramic uranium oxide gas, aerosols, and dust on Iraq. That, according to an estimate by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. What are we doing? 1-866-440-THOM, Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice.
Hi, how are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I always listen to you. I'm very political, but today I want to ask you something. It has to do with children and parenthood. How much do you think parents should be pressuring their children to get grades of, like, you know, if you get a C, well, it's the end of the world, and I'm pulling you out of this, and you're grounded for that. And I'm going through this right now because, I'm surrounded with it by parents.
Yeah.
And yet I want my kids to do well, don't get me wrong, but I have a more holistic kind of feeling about how children...
I agree with you, Janice. And in fact, if you look at the studies done in Japan, where this kind of pressure is really intense, the childhood suicide rate is through the roof. And on the other hand, you know, you look at Sweden, for example, where kids don't start school until they're 7 years old. Not a great deal of pressure. They graduate at 16 with an education that's equal to any high school graduate, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And but without the pressure, and they're doing much better as human beings. Speaking just as a parent, I would say, you know, if my child had to go to a community college for the first couple of years before they transferred to a major university, if that was their goal, was to go to university,
uh-huh,
I got no problem with that. And
right.
And in fact, I think it's probably a good thing. It'll save the parents a lot of money.
Yeah.
Kids can get the basics out of the way. A lot of kids are doing that route, in fact, right now.
They have very good professors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I am not one of those who gets all hysterical about it. But I'm telling you, there's a whole industry out there, a whole education industry that is just, you know, pumping hysteria around this. And frankly, I don't think it's healthy at all. I wrote a book that you may find interesting. It's called Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD. And although the focus of it is ADD, about a third of the book is the history of the education system in the United States. And it talks about just these issues. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. 25 and a half, if you wish. Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Lori Wallach is with us with TradeWatch.org and Public Citizen. She's the director of Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch, Citizen.org as well. Lori, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I am just great. I hope you're well today.
Thank you.
And David Sirota is in all probability going to be joining us shortly. He's a fellow with the Center for American Progress, and I wanted to get the opinion of both of you about, you know, what's been going on in the news over the last few weeks and what will be the news coming up, as it were. Say, a couple of years down the road, we look back on this point in time, this week, this few weeks, what do you think is going to be the thing that will say, you know, that was really a turning point right there?
Well, I think it's one of the stories that's not getting any coverage, surprise, surprise, except by folks like you, Tom, and that is we're 2 weeks away from a World Trade Organization summit, like the 1999 Seattle WTO summit, but this one's in Hong Kong.
Oh, my. Hong Kong, which is now increasingly
China.
Part of the police state of China. Yeah,
that's right. I have my staff here getting the bail money ready.
Oh,
the
really?
Lawyers. I'm joking halfway.
Yeah.
Basically, we've got this WTO talk that no one's paying attention to, which is something like agreeing to swallow cancer for the entire U.S. middle class, and we're all being fed it, and no one's paying attention. And the things that are on the table are something between really got awfully bad and really, really bad. And largely, it's not being discussed. Well, for instance, we've just got a bunch of new data where, say, 2 years ago when they're talking about the WTO, we heard this happy horse feathers that we'd all have $800 billion of new wealth created if there were more WTO free trade corporate agreements. funny thing. They found a math error. Now, if I did this with my checkbook, I'd be in the clink. And now they're suddenly saying, oops, actually, it's less than $100 billion. And by the way, that won't be distributed to most of us. That will be in profits. But we should all sign up for that, even though, 10 years of the WTO so far, and U.S. real median wages are down to 1972 levels.
You know, Laurie Wallach, with TradeWatch.org, I speak to politicians on this program all the time. And I just, you know, right up front say to them, why don't we abandon these idiotic trade policies, these trade agreements, WTO, NAFTA, CAFTA, GATS, trade
and
trade
services. The whole smorgasbord of death by trade.
You know, this is the great lesson that George W. Bush taught us. The wonderful thing that George W. Bush taught us is that we don't need those stinking treaties. You know, he comes into office, and the first thing he does is he walks away from the ABM, the ballistic missile treaty. He walks away from Kyoto. I mean, we could just walk away from these treaties. I mean, we literally can. We have the power to do that. And let's go back to what we had in the United States from 1787. I mean, literally, when Tench Cox got the first tariff put into place that literally in it said for the protection of domestic industries from 1787 up until, you know, 25 years ago when we started dismantling them, Reagan started dismantling them. Why don't we go back to a system of tariffs instead of this free trade nonsense?
Well, see, you're starting the debate that we should be having. In this country,
but
in the media.
I get these politicians on, and they say it's too late. You can't go back. And I'm like, you can always go back. Come on.
Yeah,
but they really believe it, Laurie.
No. But here's the thing: we have now a $700 billion trade deficit with the rest of the world. This could be understood as a total catastrophe for our economy, which it is.
Now you're talking about an annual.
Annual
deficit.
Each year. To put this in perspective, when the NAFTA and the WTO were passed, we had smaller annual trade deficits than we have every month 10 years later.
Yeah.
So we've got that going on. It's a catastrophe, no doubt, but flip side of that is it's enormous leverage. Because when the whole rest of the world's economies are relying on sending stuff to you, you actually, negotiating-wise, have them by the short and curlies.
Right, yeah. This is the old joke that, you know, when you owe your bank $500 and you can't pay it back, you've got a problem. When you owe your bank $500 million and you can't pay it back, your bank has a problem.
Yes, sir.
So,
and, you know, with the politicians, actually, in D.C., there's an increasing divide. It's very interesting. There are a variety of folks who would never contemplate having the bravery to call a chicken, which is, you know, it quacks, it's a chicken, it's got feathers, it's got clucks,
I think, actually.
And suddenly, all of a sudden, you've got politicians, including in the Senate, who are putting in legislation, for instance, to put up 30% across-the-board tariffs on China.
Right.
And so the question is, are people in this country going to force discussion of these issues? Because, I mean, no joke, if we don't get our hands around this in the next 20 years, there won't be a middle class in this country.
Yeah, and it's and that, frankly, I think is exactly what they want, because a potent middle class is a potent political force, whereas a country that's nothing but the working poor is a relatively impotent political force. And we're talking with Laurie Wallach of TradeWatch.org. David Sirota has just joined us, davidsirota.com. David, you certainly write a lot about these economic issues. My question to Laurie was, what do you think is going to be, you know, a few years from now when we look back at this point in time, what will we say was the big story? And she said the fact that the WTO meeting is going to happen in 2 weeks and nobody's even discussing it. What's your take on that, and what do you see as the big issue of the moment?
Well, I first of all, I completely agree with Laurie on the issue of trade and how basically it's been in the public debate, at least the political debate, it's been completely corrupted. We never talk about what kind of leverage this country really has, and this country basically doesn't use, not only to help our own middle class, but to sort of end the race to the bottom going on right now, whereby our trade regime gives every incentive to corporations to basically continue driving down labor, human rights, and environmental standards. I think, though, that my take on what we're going to look back on in a number of years and say, wow, what an incredible travesty it was that we didn't really address it was the whole issue of energy. I mean, the issue of energy cuts to almost every single major issue. It's an economic issue. It's a national security issue. It's an issue of of helping the developing world. It's
a huge trade issue, too.
Go ahead.
It's a huge trade issue, too.
It's a huge trade issue. You're absolutely right. I just am, I'm finishing up the book right now, The End of Oil, which is just a tremendously good read, and it's also a very frightening read. But the idea, for instance, and it's perhaps I just got through the chapter on my flight home from Thanksgiving, but, I mean, there are so many ways to go at this issue that we are not utilizing that are so easy. For instance, the issue of energy efficiency. This is an issue that has a huge potential benefit for this country, both for small businesses, for individuals. We can cut our energy usage up to 30%. It is never talked about in the political debate.
Right. Well, it hasn't been since Jimmy Carter was president.
Exactly. And the book actually goes into how a part of the reason why it's not talked about is because, you know, people harken back to Jimmy Carter putting on a sweater. And how that was like.
And they view that as a political negative. Although, you know, going into that election, he was actually doing very, very well until the hostages were taken. And that's what people forget. But that's a whole other thing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the other thing that we forget is that between the mid-70s and the mid-80s, through many things like energy efficiency, we actually did cut America's energy usage. California, for instance, its energy usage all the way up until the mid-90s, I believe, had basically flattened. And the fact that essentially now what we've got is a wholly supply-side energy policy instead of some solutions on the demand side, you know, efficiency, conservation. The fact that we have a supply-side, essentially, administration that says the way to get ourselves out of our energy problems is just to find more energy is absolutely ludicrous. It's ludicrous from a national security standpoint. It's ludicrous from a global warming standpoint. It's ludicrous from an economic standpoint in terms of competing with economically competing with countries like China and India.
Yeah. Now, well said, David Sirota. DavidSirota.com. Lori Wallach at TradeWatch.org. I'm wondering what you think is going to be, you know, to what extent is oil going to be one of the ghosts at the table at the WTO meeting in 2 weeks?
Well, I'm
in
sad.
Hong Kong.
I'm sad to say we're more likely to find WDMs in Iraq than we are going to find discussion of the role of oil in our trade mess in Hong Kong, which is to say ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, David's exactly right. We've got basically a power question here, and I don't mean just the energy part of it. It's a people power question.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have an energy policy and a trade policy, or actually non-policies that don't get discussed, that are set up intentionally to benefit very few people at enormous cost to the majority. And it's not like these policies came down somehow from God. This is just one version, and they're not talking about it.
Yeah.
And in a way, all of us, letting our elected officials get away without...
Yeah, I think everybody intuits that there's something very, very wrong. We only have about 30 seconds left. I'm wondering just, Lori, real quickly, what do you see coming up as the next big issue? Is it going to be the WTO meeting?
I don't know if it's the WTO meeting per se, but I'll tell you what, people are getting very scared of what's happening for the future for their kids. What jobs will they have? What's going to be our future? And we're going to have to make that a big issue.
Absolutely. And David Sirota, your take on the future?
My take is that we are literally coming up against a major national security and economic crisis when it comes to energy. If we don't hear something from our elected officials other than let's just drill our way out of the problem.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. In fact, I wrote a book about that called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Ancient Sunlight as well, of course. And, right there with you. Okay, great. David Sirota, davidsirota.com. Lori Wallach with TradeWatch.org, TradeWatch.org, the website. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here, sharing your wisdom and your thoughts and insights. It's 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now there are several lessons that I haven't mastered yet. I haven't got the hang of how to use the bayonet. If he doesn't die at once, am I to stick him with it more? Oh, I hope you will be patient. for I've never killed before.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Outlook column by Rafael Garina Morales in today's Wall Street Journal. Interesting, thought-provoking. I'm not even sure exactly what the word would be, but John and Mary Day. Well, just the headline. Here's the headline: Real estate boom soon may sputter as an engine of retail sales. And what they, you know, here's the caption: Consumers have been using their homes like ATMs, but that could change next year. Mortgage equity withdrawals at an annualized rate. They show on this graph, and they're projecting basically that we hit about $800 billion a year in $800 billion that in 05, actually it's nearly $1,000 billion, it's nearly $1 trillion that homeowners took out of their homes, borrowed from their homes and spent. Now, just for comparison, back in 1990, it was about $100 billion. So we're looking at $900 billion versus $100 billion. It's a ninefold increase. Basically, people are borrowing against their homes, and that's what's been driving the economy. It's what's keeping the economy going. In the face of all the statistics and all the realities that suggest that the economy should be collapsing because Bush has just driven it into the ditch, well, what's keeping it going? The fact that people are able to borrow against their homes. They're able to borrow against their homes because the values have been going up. The values have been going up because the monthly payments have been going down because interest rates have been so low, because Alan Greenspan drove the interest rates down in 2003 and 2004 so that George W. Bush could get himself reelected. That's over. Greenspan's taking them back up so that we don't have a problem with inflation. And the monthly payments are starting to go back up again. People can't borrow against their homes. And now we're going to see what the economy is really going to look like, and it's not going to be pleasant. Ed in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ed, thanks for calling. Yeah, you're live and on the air. What's up?
Hey, is this Tom?
That is.
Hey, Tom, I just had something that's driving me crazy. I just wanted to talk to you for a second.
Sure.
Try to get out of the matrix here. I keep hearing on like CNN, all the anchor babes keep asking the question, why they have experts on, and they say, why do we torture people when it's not an effective way of getting information? I mean, right. It's generally known, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What if the people that are doing the torturing know that, and what they're trying to get them to say is, I'm a terrorist?
Oh, yeah. No, the answer to the question is embedded within the question, and I'm surprised that more Americans don't get it. I mean,
yeah.
You go back and you look at the information, for example, that the Bush administration used to suggest that there were biological weapons factories in Iraq. That information was gained by torture. We knew that information was no good.
Well, there was that guy in Canada that was flying through America, and he got sent to somewhere, and he got tortured. Well, he eventually admitted he was a terrorist. And I think the guys in Guantanamo Bay, and one reason they don't want to let him go is they're nothing more than props.
Oh, yeah. I think the reason they don't want to let him go is because the six or seven that they have released have told hair-raising stories, gotten a lot of negative publicity for the United States. You multiply that times hundreds, and you've got a really serious PR problem. But, Ed, the bottom line in my mind is that the reason that we're using torture is because we will get the answers we want, not because we will get the truth. We're not interested in the truth. At least the Bush administration is not interested in the truth.
You know why? Because there is no Al-Qaeda. This is the global war on terror.
Well, there wasn't an Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was a code name that we were using to describe this network. We started using it, and Bin Laden's bunch said, hey, that's a cool name. We'll take that brand. And now the brand is stuck, and I'm telling you, there is an Al-Qaeda around the world now. But
I mean, no, I'm not saying there aren't Islamists that hate us and will blow things up, and I know that, but I'm just saying that the original Al-Qaeda, which I read, refers, Al-Qaeda translates to the base.
The base
really
of the network,
the database.
Yeah.
Of names that the CIA had for the anyway, I don't think there is a war on terror. I think there's a war to put military bases near big oil fields.
Yeah.
I am
not disagreeing with you, Ed. Not at all. Not disagreeing with you a bit. Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. There's a couple of huge stories on the front page of yesterday, Sunday's News Tribune here in Tacoma. One about the pension funds investing huge amounts of money into hedge funds, there looks like another Black Friday in the making.
Right. What we should explain to listeners who may not know, hedge funds are basically funds, you know, a mutual fund is where you put your money in and other people invest it for you in a variety of different things rather than just buying a single stock. And hedge funds are funds that are basically betting the market is going to collapse. They're funds that are set up to make money if the economy goes in the tank. And the story that you're talking about, which was in papers all across the country, is that a lot of big companies are putting their pension monies into hedge funds, which means that the really smart people who know what's going on with the economy are betting the economy is going to go in the toilet.
And the second story that is more prominent and features more highly with what you've been talking about is the Puget Sound residents embrace alternatives to fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
There's a graph here on the front page that shows that we've gone from 500,000 gallons produced in 1999 to 75 million gallons this year.
Yeah, and it's not just Puget Sound, Larry. It's happening all over the United States.
Absolutely.
Biodiesel is growing. But it's incredible. I mean, it was like, I think, 7-8 years ago, not the last time I was in Germany, but the first time I was in Germany when I actually pulled into a gas station and saw a biodiesel gas pump. They're all over the country now.
Yeah, we even have one here on Vashon Island where I live. It's a community of only 10,000 people, and we do have a biodiesel pump right here.
That's great. That's great. Larry, thanks so much for the call and for sharing that information with us. Tomorrow's program, Practical Environmental Solutions and Innovative Social Strategies for Restoring the Earth and Communities. We're going to have Senator Barbara Boxer on the program. News Hounds are going to join us with a Fox News update. It's going to be a great day. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. And remember, activism starts with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.